Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and NHK World Radio Japan. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The Israeli government announced a boycott of the country's oldest newspaper, Haaretz, for criticizing the war on Palestine. An interview with Anat Saraguzzi, chair of the Journalist Union in Israel. She says the government also canceled funding for public broadcasting in the country. Delegates from 175 countries have gathered in South Korea to attempt to create a treaty to cut back on plastic pollution. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Now, Israel's government has announced it'll boycott the country's oldest newspaper, Haaretz, following criticism of its war in Gaza. At a speech in London last month, Haaretz's publisher called for sanctions against Israel and referred to Palestinian militants as freedom fighters. The government has ordered all public entities to stop advertising with Haaretz. The left-leaning newspaper is known for its critical coverage of Israel's actions in the Palestinian territories. The paper's deputy editor has accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of trying to silence independent and critical media. And for more on this, we've invited Anat Saraguzzi onto the program. She is chair of the Journalists Union in Israel and joins me now from Tel Aviv. It's good to have you on the program, Anat. Firstly, do you agree with the deputy editor of the Haaretz paper that the Israeli government is trying to silence independent media by boycotting the paper in this way?
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think the Israeli government drafted a master plan to silence independent media in Israel and to weaken the press freedom in Israel. And the sanctions on Haaretz is only one chapter of this master plan. They also passed a resolution within the government to divest money and actually to destroy the public broadcast in Israel. This was also was decided yesterday by the same government. So these are two steps, part of this master plan.
And as you would know, there are two sides to every story. And just coming back to the boycott on the Haaretz newspaper, the communications minister, Shlomo Karhi, accuses the paper of what he says is inciting against the state of Israel. Has the paper been fully objective in its coverage?
First of all, as a journalist, you may know that objectivity no longer exists. You should be fair. You should be balanced. You should, look for the facts. You should check fact everything that you say. I mean, objectivity is not the goal in this context, if I may. And I think Haaretz is critical towards the government. It's not insightful in no way. It does bring stories from the other side, from Gaza Strip, which other media outlets don't dare do. And this is, taking their role as journalists seriously and in a responsible way. And so the government, and especially the Minister of Communication, Kari, from the minute he walked into the office, from the minute he took office, he announced that he is going to present a reform to re-regulate the independent media in Israel. And of course, Haaretz is one of his targets because he doesn't like what Haaretz depicts, the messages that Haaretz convey, and the coverage that Haaretz and the tone of Haaretz towards the government. And I remind you that us as journalists should be critical against our government wherever we are, because this is our role, you know, to shed light on dark places.
You mentioned the other outlets. How would you assess the Israeli media coverage of the war in Gaza? Is there an effort by the other media outlets to show the suffering of Palestinian civilians?
Not at all. I mean, I think that Haaretz, as a mainstream media outlet, is the only one that constantly shows what's going on in Gaza. I must say that showing what's going on in Gaza and the scale of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza doesn't necessarily mean that you support Hamas, that you are biased towards Hamas, that you lean on to Hamas, or that you deny the atrocities and the slaughter of October 7th. It means that you behave like a responsible journalist. So ours is the only one that covers Gaza intensively, daily. The other media outlets don't dare do that. I think, unfortunately, the Israeli public is not open to listen to anything coming out of the other side of the border. They cannot contain the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. So they don't understand the humanitarian crisis there, and they don't see what the rest of the world sees in terms of the atrocities and the war and the huge destruction there and the human lives that has been paid, more than 43,000 people, casualties in Gaza already. So the Israeli public does not see that in terms of what they see in or what they watch on mainstream television.
Anat, we appreciate that. Thank you so much for weighing in on the story for us. That is Anat Saragusti, chair of the Journalists Union in Israel.
Just a day after the massive United Nations climate conference wrapped up in Azerbaijan, delegates from 175 countries have now gathered in South Korea to hash out a treaty on global plastic pollution. As the event kicked off today, familiar divisions have arisen, suggesting that deal making is going to be a difficult task. Countries that bear the brunt of plastic pollution are struggling to reach agreement with petrochemical producing nations like China and Saudi Arabia. Now, the amount of plastic waste produced globally has been climbing sharply, and if it's left unchecked, scientists say it could double or even triple over the next decades. Right now, it is thought more than 52 million tons enter the environment each and every year. So it's a problem that needs urgent attention. Here's what's being said as those talks get underway in South Korea.
This conference is about far more than drafting an international treaty. It is about humanity racing to meet an existential challenge.
This is your chance to craft an agreement for the ages, one that could deliver a thousand of years free from plastic, one that at the end of this week, the gavel must come down.
Differences in views still remain on key issues, including plastic production, controllable plastic products and chemicals.
The decisions made here will determine whether we confront the plastics crisis with the ambition it demands, or allow the fossil fuel and petrochemical interests to derail progress. A weak treaty is a failed treaty.
That interview and report were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, France 24. First, a press review from The Guardian about the importance of the plastic summit in South Korea, pointing out the presence of microplastics in every placenta tested. Science editor Julia Seeger discusses the divisions at the Plastic Summit, with countries producing the petroleum and chemicals looking for more profits, and the others who want a legally binding reduction in the production and usage of plastic. She explains how plastic recycling is largely a toxic myth and alternative materials lack the ease of use. There is, however, a newer type of plastic that might offer hope. Then Belgian journalist Elijah Magnier talks about how the effect of the ceasefire on Lebanon might have on the war on Palestine. He says the only objective of the current fighting is to prepare northern Gaza to be annexed for new settlers to develop. France 24.
An article in The Guardian this morning showing perhaps just how important these talks are. You can see the headline. According to experts, in just 10 years' time, the world will simply be unable to cope with the volume of plastic. This year, various researchers found microplastics in every sample of placenta they tested in human arteries, where plastics are linked to heart attacks and strokes. Use of plastic could triple globally by 2060, with the largest increases expected in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. Plastic waste also projected to triple by 2060. And according to many, we're very soon going to reach a point of no return.
So, will the international community manage to come to an agreement to fight plastic pollution? That question is on everybody's minds as representatives from across the globe meet in the South Korean city of Busan. The challenge ahead is significant. Plastics represent a threat to the environment, to biodiversity, and also human health. And I'm joined in the studio by our science editor, Julia Seeger, who's been following these talks. Countries are divided on this issue, Julia, and those deep differences have really dogged four previous rounds of talks in the last 2 years. So are they going to be able to reach an agreement this time around?
Well, that's a good question, but countries are indeed still very much divided. On one hand, you have countries including France that want a final legally binding text with a very clear and strict wording on the reduction of the production of plastic worldwide. And on the other, you have many countries, mainly oil producing countries, who want, of course, the opposite, less restrictive objectives to be able to continue producing plastic. And the reason why is because they see plastic as an economic opportunity going ahead, especially at a time when fossil fuels and thermal engines are losing ground to electrification. As you know, 90% of plastic is actually a derivative of oil and gas. So they see it as an economic opportunity. And their argument is going to be to say that, well, we don't need to reduce the production, but we need to focus a little bit more on collecting and recycling. Now, the issue is that when you actually look at this so-called principle of the three R's, which is reduce, reuse, and recycle, the problem with the reuse and recycling and this idea that we could create a circular economy with plastic is that more and more it looks like it's a pipe dream. For one, because of the amount of plastic that we're talking about. For two, because most of the plastic is not recyclable. You only have two categories of plastics that you can recycle. So 90% of plastic waste is never recycled. And here are the two families that you can actually recycle. The other problem is that the process of recycling plastic is actually harmful for the environment because it creates these microplastic particles that then go in the environment, in our water, our rivers, and our fields, and then, of course, in our plates. And we found some of those particles in the human brain, the human heart, even in the maternal milk. So it's absolutely everywhere. Now, the other problem is that you can't use recyclable plastic for everything. You can't use it, for instance, to contain food because of risks of toxicity. And the last issue is that there's no economic incentive because recycled plastic is actually much more expensive than new plastic. So that's why it's going to be quite an issue, and that's why a lot of countries are now pushing for a reduction of the production specifically.
The production of plastic continues to increase. We produce, I understand, somewhere around 460 million tonnes of plastic each year in the world, twice as much as it was 20 years ago.
That's right, and if we project ourselves to 2060, it could actually triple. Now, plastic is everywhere, in clothing, in beauty products, of course, also in packaging. We see it everywhere. And you may ask, well, why haven't we ever found an alternative to plastic? And the answer is that we have alternatives. We have glass, cellulose, cardboard, but every time it seems like it only serves one purpose. It's actually hard to find a material that imitates completely plastic because plastic is resistant, it's flexible, it's cheap, it can be used by all types of industry, all usage. It's also very, and I think that's the most important point, it offers a high level of food safety. And so that's also why we haven't used anything else. But once again, there are lots of other alternatives. Maybe we can take a look at them. But there are always advantages and disadvantages for each one. It's not a fit-all solution. Now, maybe the only one that really gets close to what we have today is a more durable plastic called VPR. It's based on vitrimer epoxy resin, and it was developed by the University of Tokyo and is both resistant, it's malleable, it's recyclable. And what's really interesting is that it's actually partly biodegradable, especially when it's been exposed to seawater. So it biodegrades by itself. And what is actually left, the fragments that are left, can actually are not toxic and can be used as food for the fish. So what's really interesting, and here you can see this new type of plastic, when you warm it up, you can actually reform it. You know, it's very malleable once again. And what's interesting is that I think this is going to be the most important point, that scientists are going to have to find a real alternative to plastic to be able to get out of this situation. And it seems like this VPR plastic actually is more environmentally friendly on all stages of its life cycle.
Julia, thank you so much.
There are fears for the fate of the Gaza Strip, with Israel now able to direct its military effort on the Palestinian territory. The health ministry in the Hamas-run Gaza said this Wednesday that at least 44,282 people now have been killed in more than 30 months of war between Israel and the Palestinian militants of Hamas. This toll includes 33 deaths over the past 24 hours, according to the ministry, which said over 104,000 people have been wounded in Gaza. Still, Elijah Manier joins us, veteran war correspondent and senior political risk analyst. Thank you so much for being with us. Over 44,000 dead in Gaza. How do you see the story developing there in the wake of the deal in Lebanon?
I don't think anything is going to happen in Gaza that is positive for the Palestinians before the new administration is in office. I don't think Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going to make any concessions to the Palestinians, because there is a kind of revenge against Gaza, which is completely different from the situation in Lebanon. This is why we have seen the Israeli army completely isolating part of the north, trying to occupy it and trying to empty the first part, I mean, half of the north at the level of Jabalia camp and Jabalia city, and trying to evacuate as many civilians as possible. Gaza really is devastated, destroyed. Many people have been completely displaced. And now the only objective of the far right-wing government is to annex this part of the north and give it to new settlers, as it was the case before 2005. Benjamin Netanyahu has failed in achieving his objective, militarily speaking. So in the military terms, it is not by killing as many civilians as your figures, 43,300, which are very accurate, and then to destroy Gaza. That is not an achievement, because all the captives are still in captivity, and he did not manage militarily to liberate them. And we see little interest for the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, actually, people like the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and Ben-Gvir, that the security minister, said this is not the priority. The priority is the interest of Israel, and the hostages are not the priority. Therefore, the shift of Benjamin Netanyahu's objective from defeating Hamas, which didn't happen, because particularly in the month of November, the highest number of Israeli soldiers and officers were killed in Jabalia and Ashate in the north of Gaza. And the battle is still ongoing because Hamas did not raise the white flag and Israel did not free the prisoners. And in Lebanon is exactly the same. Benjamin Netanyahu did not manage to push Hezbollah by the military means beyond the Litani River.
Netanyahu spoke about dealing with the Iranian threat, the Iran threat. What do you think he meant by that? Is that something that he alone can address? Or is this really something part of a bigger picture that involves the United States?
Without the United States, Germany and the UK, Israel would have never did what it has done in Gaza and in Lebanon. The support that is offered by the allies is essential. The Israeli army, although they have 450,000 troops and all the effective that is one of the most formidable in the Middle East and one of the best in the world, they did not show the same level of capability and professionalism. Therefore, talking about Iran when 364 square kilometers in Gaza were not possible to occupy and defeat Hamas, and 500 square kilometers, that is from the border to the south of the Litani River in Lebanon, and the Israeli army failed with five divisions, we're talking about 60 to 80,000 troops, to occupy that area after 50 days, when they managed to do that in 2006 in 33 days, going to Iran is just tackling the feeling that is emanating from Donald Trump, who said his next direction is going to be to talk to Iran. But also, this is the language that Netanyahu is addressing domestically to make sure that people are still afraid, that he still has a job to do before November 2026, and it is not time yet for him to be removed or an early election in Israel.
Elijah Banier, veteran war correspondent, senior political risk analyst, joining us from Brussels. Thank you, sir, very much indeed for your analysis. Much appreciated.
Those interviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or can help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. Or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join the gang. And if you are listening on a public radio station, please, they need your support as well. We will conclude with NHK Japan. The Japanese government has proposed a new greenhouse gas target, which will achieve zero net emissions sooner than previously planned. The Australian House has passed the bill banning children under 16 from social media to reduce bullying, suicide, and sexual exploitation. Elon Musk called the bill censorship, and Prime Minister Albanese called Musk an arrogant billionaire. NHK Japan.
Japan's government has proposed a new target to reduce the country's greenhouse gas output. It envisions a cut of 60% in fiscal 2035 compared to fiscal 2013 levels. The proposal came Monday at a meeting of a panel of experts from the Environment and Industry Ministries. The government says it'll consider the new target while taking into account the opinions of panel members. The government currently calls for a 46% reduction by fiscal 2030 compared to fiscal 2013. This is part of the efforts to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. Countries are required to submit their new emission targets for 2035 to the United Nations by next February. Carbon reduction goals were a key topic at the UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, held in Azerbaijan earlier this month. Britain announced at the meeting it'll aim to reduce emissions by 81% compared to 1990 levels by 2035. The Paris Agreement urges efforts to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Australia has moved a step closer to introducing a law banning children under 16 from social media. The House of Representatives passed the bill on Wednesday, but it still needs Senate approval. 102 lower house lawmakers voted for the ban, and just 13 opposed.
If the bill is enacted, operators of social media platforms will have to take measures to prevent children from setting up accounts. Companies that fail to do so will be fined up to nearly 50 million Australian dollars, about 32 million US dollars. There are no penalties for underage children or their parents. The legislation targets platforms including Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and X. YouTube and sites that do not require accounts could be exempted. NHK's Sydney Bureau Chief Matsuda Nobuko explains why Australian lawmakers decided to introduce such strict regulation and the challenges in making it effective.
This bill was prompted by a growing sense of urgency, especially among parents. There's a seemingly endless number of cases of children being bullied or sexually exploited through social networking sites. Some children have even been driven to suicide. There have been growing calls for restrictions on social media platforms, particularly from parents. The government has responded with a tough stance. It demanded that operators remove harmful content and they face fines if they do not comply. When footage of a stabbing attack at the church in Sydney went viral in April, the government asked Elon Musk's X social media platform to remove the video. Musk criticized that as censorship, which prompted Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to label him an arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law. If the bill becomes law as expected, it won't come into force for at least a year. And the biggest challenge to making it work is how to verify age. The government is planning to outsource age verification trials to a private company. An official from the company commissioned by the government told me that there are several methods to determine age. They include facial biometric verification, as well as ID card and email history. Another challenge is ensuring personal data is protected. They are concerned that personal information may be provided to social media platforms to verify age. And there is still the loophole that it will be possible for children under 16 to create a social media account using a VPN on a server outside Australia.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp and at most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look even harder these days because of increasing U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I am recuperating from spinal injuries, I am staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.